In northwesternmost Belarus, in the village of Znint, there occurs each November 6th a giant potato festival.
Is the festival giant, or are the potatoes giant?
This remains to be seen.
Ooh, that's what I wanted to know!
All during October, the village's womenfolk strip the surrounding fields bare of potatoes. The harvesting is not as straightforward as it sounds. Some of the potatoes have developed simple motor skills, allowing them to either run away, albeit very slowly, or stay and defend themselves, employing a rudimentary form of jiu-jitsu. But judging from the potato versus villager confrontations so far, the former still have a ways to evolve before mankind might feel threatened. After the potatoes have been subdued, the womenfolk carefully pack them in excelsior and take them to town. Some potatoes are too large for the women to carry. Those that can move on their own are guided to the village by the guild of great Znint potato shepherds. Any strays are left for the packs of forest-dwelling feral border collies to feast on. The non-ambulatory oversized spuds are rolled to town in a kind of jaunty competition. The 13th potato to cross the finish line wins, though a prize has never been determined or awarded. Once in town, they are placed in the great Znint potato pit, where they are crushed by tapers. Perspiration from the ungulates combines with the potato mash to form a robust vodka. The vodka is decanted into a colossal tun and carted to the great Znint potato shrine, which sits on the banks of the mysterious Budnink River.
Budnink River? I want to be there!
Then the youth who has been selected from the village middle school to be the great Znint potato sacrifice is led, sometimes willingly, to the top of the shrine and lashed to the scaffold there. 100 butane torches are ignited as the ceremonial drums beat out the hypnotic rhythm that, along with ululations from the village choraleers, will summon the great Znint potato god. Oh my god.
If they come in, there they go.
And then, usually simultaneous with the annual solar eclipse, there emerges from the great Nevsky Forest a hobgoblin of breathtaking proportions. Measuring nearly 40 feet from its tank-like tread to the top of its compound eye sacs, Monsieur Tête de la Pomme de Terre.
Ah, Tête de la Pomme de Terre! I have heard of him!
Mr. Potato Head is one of the scariest denizens of the Belarusian highlands. Oh, he's fine, even docile, when he first approaches the shrine, but once the sacrificial vodka hits his taste buds, Mr. Potato Head's mood turns as dark as the sun, and it starts looking for bear. And those innocuous-looking plastic eyes can spot a potential victim at 90 paces. The ears and nose, too, are super-sensitive organs of detection. And you only need to examine the remains of former sacrificial youths to determine how deadly the blood-red mouth and meerschaum pipe are. You know, that's scary, but in a different way.
You have to be away from those kinds of ceremonies or things happen to you.
Gee. It is late afternoon on the 6th of November, 2004. In the village's mint, the vodka has been flowing since morning, and the citizenry are in boisterously high spirits. This year's winner of the annual Tête de la Pomme de Terre look-alike contest is a cobbler's Dzugashvili goat, which elicits a roar of laughter from the townspeople. The great Znint potato sacrifice was not as agreeable as those in years past. Fleeing to one of the hiking huts that dot the mountain passes, the lad had sought asylum from its resident Sherpa. The Sherpa wisely refused him succor. He himself had once felt Mr. Potato Head's wrath, and he personally hauled him back to the village. At the moment, the mayor of Zmint is rewarding
the Schmint Schmerpa,
with an official Tête de la Pomme de Terre bobblehead.
Oh, I have to have him again, please.
With an official Tête de la Pomme de Terre bobblehead.
I gathered quite a crowd this time.
So. Oh, wow. A ruckus breaks out down in the potato bin. Down in the potato bin. One of the tapers, presumably giddy from the potato mash, has escaped and is running amok in the streets. The townspeople are too swacked to catch it, and the taper races through the village, eventually finding itself at the top of the potato shrine. In the distance, it spots a giant brown-skinned ovoid form hunkering amidst a copse of trees. Monsieur Tête de la Pomme de Terre. The taper, and right about now, we must wonder if it's really just a plain nocturnal odd-toed ungulate of the Malay Peninsula, backs up against the tun of vodka and gives the stave a vicious kick. The cask ruptures, and the vodka cascades down into the mysterious Zudnik River below. Monsieur Tête de la Pomme de Terre. Oh, it's gone. Seeing his long-awaited nectar drain away from him, comes out of hiding and races to plug the hole in the cask, bellowing ferociously. The Coraliers, who had been assembling for the great Zmint potato ululation, shriek in horror. Just as the sun disappears behind the moon and the village is plunged into darkness. And then, according to step 14 of an utterly remarkable plan, the taper wrests a fiery butane torch from one of the Coraliers and drops it into the river. The vodka, floating atop the water, catches fire, as does a bewildered Monsieur Tête de la Pomme de Terre. The fire is intense, and within scant minutes, Mr. Potato Head has turned into the world's largest home fry. The taper then pulls out, from where I'm loath to say, a global positioning system PDA and presses the map send button. Moments later, two modified Huey helicopters descend rapidly from the sky. One deploys a giant paring knife. The other, six jumbo Ziploc plastic bags. Together they skillfully harvest the erstwhile Monsieur Tête de la Pomme de Terre. For the helicopter's crack crew are from the Betty Crocker Kitchens, which is poised to enter the lucrative domain of the pre-processed potato product. Amidst all of the chaotic confusion, no one notices a second oversized brown-skinned ovoid form lurking in the forest. It wipes a tear from one of its many eyes, memorizes the Betty Crocker insignia on the sides of the helicopters, and swears revenge.
And off they go.
After you partake of this 492nd episode of Calvus and Damien's New Music Bazaar, dear listeners, we hope you'll swear, too. Swear to pledge support for this fine radio station and its assigns, which indirectly includes your always obedient servants, Damien and Calvus.
Hi there. Well, that was just juicy. Wow.
The things we do for our radio audience.
Ah, yes, because, of course, it's fundraising. We need to entertain you more than usual, because otherwise we'll have to offer you prizes like this sign that says, Tunes for Tots. Are you kidding? You think we're going to give away Rafi on this show? Or birthday party sing-along? Or Mozart for Christmas? Instead, we offer you interviews and music of the difficult kind, including right now you're listening to music by Ernesto Diaz-Infante. He's one of our two interview guests today. We'll wrap up our interview with Chris Brown, and then we'll have the full interview with Ernesto Diaz-Infante. But in the meantime, 802-454-7762. It's fundraising at WGDR. Pledge because you lost the darn election. Come on now, let's hear from you. Woo! Ernesto Diaz Infante, who'll be our guest in just a little while on Calvocentania.
How much of a little while?
A little while, maybe 15 minutes or so. That was Death Valley, Restless and Tired.
I'll say.
It goes along with Monsieur Tête de la Pomme de Terre.
Yeah.
That's from his CD, Chaos Bohol. Almost Bohor, which is kind of the Zanakis
case. Or Niels Bohor.
Or Niels Bohor, right. So we'll hear from Ernesto in a little while, and right now we're going to go back to California to finish up our interview with Chris Brown.
Just a little announcement.
Oh, yes, of course. We have our first 15 minutes.
Isn't that amazing? We have a pledge of great support of an unknown person who sometimes goes under the name of Shmi.
Shmi, yes, along with Monsieur de la Pomme de Terre.
Yes. And it's most gratifying to receive this and most helpful, and we're that much closer to
We are, in fact, $200 closer
that
to
much
our goal.
More, yes. Excellent.
So 802-454-7762. And we're depending on our internet listeners as well. We know we have some. And those of you who listen to Calvocentamian online, please give us a call. The country code is 1 if you're calling from somewhere else. And we can get some funds by PayPal if there are no other way. So 802-454-7762.
And we do take Canadian currency.
We take any kind of currency.
Yes.
I'll take Zwatis. I'll take Rubles.
And what's the gold standard now?
I will take the gold standard.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you to Aggie, and thank you to everyone. Please call us 802-454-7762. Back to California and Chris Brown.
That's from Oasis.
Or was from.
Chris Brown, you have something else on this LP release that we have in front of us, the Calvis and Damien privilege of having an LP in front of us. This has alternating currents on one side, but the A side.
The A side and the title track is a piece that's called Branches, and its subtitle is Invention Number 7. This was the last in a series of inventions that were really attempts to work with computers and rhythm interactively with different players. And this piece was composed for one of the Other Minds festivals here a couple years ago, and it was to feature my great friend and collaborator William Wynant on percussion, but also someone who I started to work with earlier in that series, the invention series, a DJ who came out of the Mission District here named Eddie Deff. And this guy convinced me that DJing is like playing the violin. If you get far enough into it, it is just he is able to match pitches and exactly respond to any kind of rhythmic gesture that I can come up with. And he was a total virtuoso. I'd never seen that kind of virtuosity with turntables, and so I decided I had to make a piece that he could be part of. So this was a trio. In a way, it was kind of like the Room idea, where you've got three players who are working with material but also improvising. And Eddie, of course, doesn't read music, but he had a track that he was listening to and responding to. Willie had a track he was listening to and responding to. I had one. And we're all working with tempi that are in different meters at the same time. So it was a big polymetric stew. And all of us synchronized, but somehow in our own space at the same time, trying to create a vast churning rhythm that the listener can move up and down through a big texture and listen to. So people move out on one branch of the rhythm or another branch. There's a lot going on in the piece. So that's the title track, and we played it on the festival, and we recorded it a year later.
And this is a studio recording.
It's a studio recording, yeah.
This LP, for those of you who still have LP players, what are they called? Record players, that's what they are. And was this ecstatic piece LP? Chris Brown is our guest on Helmets and Damien. This is Invention Number 7, Branches. Thank you. Chris Brown with William Winant and Eddie Def on the this wonderful LP. I love saying that word. We have so few opportunities to say that.
Well, I know that they're in the stores now, but there were only 400 of them pressed.
That's part
of this series. So hopefully we'll get a CD release longer, further down the road. But it's kind of a special thing that Ecstatic Peace does.
Any advice to composers coming into the field now?
Make your own, and don't be afraid to move away from your model. Work with what's local. Try to bring your local color into what you're doing, and just don't let people tell you that what you're doing is somehow not valid. It's valid, and you just need to get behind it.
Chris Brown, thanks so much for joining us on Calvis and Damien.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Indeed it was. He said local, and we will do local. Shall we do our local right now?
Did you say loco?
Loco. Local business. Business local.
Hmm.
Local 197 of Calvis and Damien.
Hi, I'm Chris Brown, and you're listening to the Calvis and Damien's New Music Bazaar. It's your one stop for non-pop on the Non-Pop International Network.
Here on WGDR Plainfield.
Which is just standing by awaiting a call from a wealthy listener. Not necessarily entirely wealthy, but just wealthier than we are.
Indeed. 802-454-7762. Chris Brown said local, and so we got local music. And if you make a pledge, we can provide you with local music from Cody Michaels or Grace Potter or Derek Semler. Colin McCaffrey, yes, indeed. And, of course, we had some a great contribution of CDs from Allison Mann, Patty Casey, Abby Jenny Band, and Dave Keller Band. So, come on.
Not to mention all the lot of CDs that Calvis and Damien can provide for certain pledge.
Yes, things. If you want some arbitrary new music sounds, we can send you them. We have lots of CDs. We won't tell you about them here, but things from Andrew Schultz and strange piano compositions. And
things you
Margaret
hear
Lancaster.
Right.
Yeah, you just can't hear them every day. We got dozens of them. And
you can't hear them here either unless you fork over some cash.
Yes. We're going to go to our interview with Ernesto Diaz-Infante in just a second. But I should mention that we always say that we're flagship of the Non-Pop International Network.
And what network might that what might comprise the network?
Yes, Non-Pop International Network stations.
There.
We have more of them. Actually, just to fill you in, we have stations in the U.S., Canada, Brazil, France, Croatia, the Netherlands, Finland, and Australia. We'd like to welcome three new members of the Non-Pop International Network.
This is official now.
Yeah, that's right. On WXXE-FM in Syracuse, New York, Phil de Chateauvieux hosts Show Me the Music. That's Mondays at noon to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And then on KVRX in Austin, yes, indeed, Late Night with Statler and Waldorf. And that's on from 11 to 1 a.m. Wednesday evening to Thursday morning on KVRX.org or KVRX 91.7 FM in Austin, Texas. And finally, just today, we confirmed the membership of Elektra Music, Nicecast Radio. It's on first Thursday of each month at 7 p.m. or the following Sunday at 5 p.m. And the name of the show, Elektra Music, hosted by Paul Clouvel.
And this is where?
In Paris.
Paris.
Yes. The three new members of the Non-Pop International Network.
Not Paris, Texas?
Not Paris, Texas. Austin, Texas. Paris, France.
Got it.
I don't think there's an Austin, France. There might be. An Austin Healy.
An Austin Powers.
Yes. Sigh.
Ernie. Right. Ernie.
Please, Ernie. Folks, we're waiting to hear from you. 802-454-7762. We'll wait right here for another few seconds before we head off to California again and the interview with Ernesto Diaz-Infante. I should also mention that our own show, which is privately produced and broadcast here on WGDR, needs assistance, and Argosy Foundation helped out in our transportation to California for the interviews you're listening to. And the production expenses of our show, we had help with Tom Hamilton, Steve Layton, Tim Minnell, Noah Krzyzewski, and Dan Albertson. So
there's
the phones ringing, so let's go out to California, and we'll take that pledge. Here we go. It's Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar on the road. We're here in San Francisco at Jerry Gerber's studio. We're very happy that Jerry's hosted us for this series. And our guest here with us right now is Ernesto Diaz-Infante. Welcome to Calvos and Damien.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
We've been receiving your recordings. Never heard you work live, but we've been receiving your recordings for years now. And we want to know how the heck you do all this. Because you've been really prolific, incredibly prolific.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a little bit about your background.
Uh-huh.
And how long you've been working, where you studied, and just in general about
okay.
you.
Wow. Let's see, where do I begin? Let's see. Well, but I studied music composition at UC Santa Barbara, undergraduate degree there. At the College of Creative Studies, and I studied with Margaret Mayer, this wonderful composer, and then from there I went on to CalArts and studied composition there, MFA program, with Stefan Lucky-Mosco and Leo Avodada-Smith, and it was an interesting time there. Kind of just, I've always been, I guess, open, just kept open to, like, ideas and new ideas and approaches and aesthetics. So, you know, so I did everything there. It's such a wonderful environment there. Everything from, you know, playing like Javanese music to like studying electronics with Morton Subotnick or Tomer over there. So, yes. What else? Got involved in music pretty early. You know, I started, you know. We got piano lessons at 7.
The childhood piano
yeah.
lessons.
Actually, it was the organ lessons.
Ah, oh, okay.
Playing the, you know, the Wurlitzer or whatever console organ, and that's where my start was, you know, and then, you know, just the typical rebellion, you know, as a teenager, and then got into playing like in rock groups, and I grew up in my father was from Mexico. And my mother is Mexican, but her family is from Mexico, so she was born in California. So I just grew up a lot of music, a lot of, you know, Spanish, Mexican music playing in the house. And then just, you know, high school got involved in, you know, marching band. You know.
Marching band, even yeah. the marching band. If I had to guess origins for your music, I would never say marching band.
Yeah. Did the whole marching band thing and playing glockenspiel and you know, mallets and you know, I actually got into that so I could avoid being in PE, you know, first period. So I say, well, everybody's like drinking hot chocolate, and it, you know, what the musicians are in the music, you know, band, and I'm just like, I want to be there, you know.
The phys ed requirement, I think, has produced more great musicians in America.
Yeah, and yeah, you know, just off and on, and then. At 14, I basically dropped out of school and played in a in this Mexican group, a Spanish group called Cielo Azul, and played keyboards, and it was mostly playing like cumbia music and rancheras, ballads. And that was a wild story, and I finally I spent like a year there, and then returned back to that was in Fresno, and then went back to
school. What made it a wild story?
Just, you know, got involved with, you know, just drugs and stuff, you know, and,
oh, that kind of wild story, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, this is like the mid-80s, you know, yeah. Kind of early 80s, and my parents were just pretty open, too. I mean, they were traditional in a way, but then, you know, they hadn't, you know, finished school or anything. My father was an inventor of agriculture machinery.
Uh-huh.
So he was kind of, that's what you want to do, music, go right ahead, you know, I can't tell you what to do, I can't tell you to get finish school because I didn't finish it, so they're very open. So I had a lot of, you know, just interesting experiences growing up, and then, you know, and then, when I lived in Castroville, or Prunedale, which is a small rural community outside of Salinas, Central California.
That area kind of... in literature, known for its agriculture and workers. And
yeah. And John Steinbeck, yeah.
Sure, Steinbeck, yeah.
So at that time, that's when I started kind of experimenting with kind of multi-tracking, kind of like, you know, just as a 14, 15-year-old kid and missing a lot of school and just... I guess I spent a lot of time just making kind of like these songs and overdubbing with various instruments. And at the time, it was just like this fantasy world, you know, as a teen. And I just, I still have those tapes. And actually, there's a small cassette label out of Nebraska, Seagull, that's going to release some of that early stuff. And, you know, just played church organ and at the church. And
at during services?
Services,
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, made some money playing, you know, weddings and the playing the mass and all that stuff. And then I just went off to school. I graduated early, went to continuation high school.
So you went back to school.
Yeah. Yeah. Went back to school.
Yeah.
You know, kind of got my act together. I didn't want to work at Kmart all my life.
And you're lucky, because if Kmart folds, then you would have been out of work.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
Nothing like being a musician for making money.
Yeah. So it's just been just really this interesting adventure. I mean, I'm 35 now, and so I went back to school, and for a while I was kind of a little bit lost, because I knew I really wanted to do music, and it was just my folks, we were more practical and said, like, study, you know, business, study something so you can, you know, have, you know, a job and then do this as on the side as a hobby. And then finally, you know, my early 20s, I kind of just broke away from that. And so, you know, studying, like, government and poli-sci and kind of interest in Chicano politics and getting involved with the Chicano political group there at college. And I guess it was a good learning. It seems like all these things, early experiences have really helped us, you know, I've gone through a life, you know, like the organizing, like, you know, organizing a series that I did for 2.5 years at the Luggage Store Gallery in San Francisco. So it just came really natural, just drawing back on those things and also those music things. So when I got serious, this was like in 89, 90, to study music, I just, you know, went back, you know, got all of my, you know, prerequisites, music, and, you know, applied at UC Santa Barbara, and boom, since 91, it's just been like, you know, it's been really interesting. Yeah.
Let's hear something to start with.
Sure.
Almost anything's a good introduction to your work, but choose something for us.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I mean, maybe something like, well, let's see here. I mean, there's some early piano work that I did when I first got out of CalArts. That might be a good introduction. Most people really seem to like the UCross Journal.
Yeah. All right. Let's hear from that. And in the wormhole time of Calvis and Damien's delayed broadcast, you'll know what it is before I do. Our guest is Ernesto Diaz Infante. Thank you. Our guest is Ernesto Diaz Infante. We listened to a cut from U Cross Journal. How do you work? When we started first receiving your recordings, we were mostly noticing the fact that of all the material we've heard in recent years from different people, yours was among the quietest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. I'm really open. You know, I've studied like aesthetics and studied all these different traditions of music, contemporary classical music and 20th century music. So, once I started creating music, I really like don't really think about anything of like either aesthetics or dogma. I just kind of create the music, and it really depends on what mood I'm in, what's happening in my life, and really feel like the environment, you know, really affects me too, where I'm living, you know, how are things going in my life, personal life. So the early piano work was sort of representative, sort of like I'd gotten out of CalArts, and I was really interested at the time, playing a lot of piano. You know, I'd spent a year in residence, doing this residency in Nice, France at Serum. It was sort of a graduate exchange program at CalArts, and I was just focused on piano and playing a lot of Erik Satie, a lot of Thelonious Monk at the time, and it was a wonderful experience. And living in France, you know, I never had the experience before, and it was just I had so much time to really think and plan and dream and strategize. And so when I got back to California, you know, I decided to create a label to document my work. You know, but first I tried sending my stuff out, and you know, people didn't know who I was.
A hopeless state of affairs. Yeah.
So I created Posh Recordings label, and I decided to put out a solo piano recording. And at the time, I was just writing more. I was really interested in just writing kind of these pieces where I would notate, you know, these ideas. And use them kind of like a springboard for improvisation, you know, kind of shape them while I was in the studio.
These were not structured improvisations; they were just sort of a sketched idea that you used to start them.
Right.
Closer
right.
to it. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the first recording, Itzat, it was just like these pieces that I actually notated, and when I went into the studio, you know, just. I would just kind of like, you know, play around with the duration of the notes or you know, kind of go within it. With U Cross, also kind of the quiet pieces were also affected because I was doing a lot of residencies too, like going to these art retreats where you have a month just to compose and hang out, and I would write these pieces. And, you know, at the time I was writing chamber music, and I was writing piano music because it was much easier because I knew I could perform them. And U Cross was just... you know, it was just pretty much encompassed that environment in Wyoming, just the middle of everything, and was really interested in Morton Feldman's music, you know, and
where did you get introduced to Morton Feldman's music?
At CalArts.
At CalArts.
Yeah, and a little bit at UC Santa Barbara, but Stefan Moskow had, he had an association with Morton Feldman, and so he was, you know, always turning his students on to like the recordings and scores and stuff.
His star is rising late in the United States, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Feldman, yeah.
Yeah. And I've always I'd studied so much music, so many composers' music, and Morton Feldman's music really spoke to me. You know, just it drew me in. And, it was sort of like. Sort of an aesthetic that I really enjoyed and I found just fascinating, kind of not just as a kind of constructing music and organizing music, but also there's like some kind of like spirituality going through the music that I feel when I listen to Morton Feldman. And so U Cross was sort of that idea. I had sketched out sort of like Morton Feldman-esque scores and just you know, springboard off them. But lately, it's just been it's funny because I look back and it's interesting archive and kind of documenting work because it's interesting just to go back and see where I'm kind of evolving, and it's just through meeting people, collaborating with other musicians. I mostly work with improvisation right now with other improvisers, and so I've kind of gone through different approaches to music or styles, but I've always felt that the music that I do kind of still is grounded in a certain, you know, from the early works, you know.
Let's listen to one of the improvisations with others.
Okay. Probably the collaboration with Chris Forsyth, a guitarist from New York City, and our latest release is called March.
Okay. Our guest is Ernesto Diaz-Infante. We'll be right back.
Not back as soon as you think, because it's still time
to
fundraise.
Oh, right.
802-454-7762. We are awaiting your call. We have raised, since our last break, another $100.
Woohoo.
Thank you very much for that. It was actually raised in behest of Democracy Now!, but we took the call, so we're polishing our fingernails.
But this is Democracy Music Now.
Yes! Yes, this is elitist music now. You kidding? No democracy here.
No tunes for tots.
No tunes for tots. 802-454-7762. Please give us a call. We'll listen to excerpts from March by Ernesto Diaz-Infante and Chris Forsyth.
from the collaboration with Chris Forsyth, that's from CD March, Ernesto Diaz Infante. You mentioned something earlier twice, and it got my attention because it does not seem to be a commonplace among composers and performers to be concerned about documenting what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
Why did that intrigue you? Was it sort of a self-study? What was your interest in sort of documenting your progress as an artist?
There's so many ideas behind that. I guess one of them is I've always been sort of kind of envious of like painters, you know, like visual artists, you know, because they can paint something and it's there, you know, the work exists. And like my frustration with writing chamber music or contemporary music, military music, was that you write this beautiful score and you spent months and months, and then, you know, you just hope that, you know, you'll get a it'll come to life. Someone will play mm-hmm. it or get a reading. And it just felt like it didn't feel really gratifying. And also just coming from, you know, being exposed to like, you know, like popular music and rock music, and just the idea of like making demos and, you know, having an album and CD just really kind of spoke to me. And so with the CDs, I really love documenting, because it's just kind of like, you know, I go into the studio and make this music, and it just feels like a finished work, sort of like a painting. And I can go back to and listen to and you know, draw ideas from the different CDs, and partly that, and also to sort of like preserve sort of like what I'm doing, you know, just like, you know, I've just heard so many stories about great musicians, and you know, they're just, you know, they don't, you know, just don't have anything documented, and that's another issue, another interest of, you know, why I document my work and stuff. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of a journal. Some people have been known to keep journals for years and years and years of in detail of their work. This is a sort of an excerpted audio journal, because you do step out of your day to day into a studio to do it. So.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
You're a multi-instrumentalist as well.
Yes. Yes. I play, you know, guitar, piano, on the solo recording that I just this is the most recent solo recording. I, you know, just played a bunch of instruments, and you know, I think I've been blessed in the fact that I'm not really afraid afraid to create in the moment. You know, I can pick up a didgeridoo, I can pick up a mimbera, and I spend time with it before I record or before I document something. But it's that kind of like childlike curiosity that I think I've always had. I have like an early memory of music, and you know, when I was like 5 or 6, I was over at a family gathering, and my family would get together, and all my cousins would be playing the organ, and sort of it's like this kind of a little bit competitive, because it'd be like, oh, you know, cousin so and so is playing, cousin so. And I just remember one time just being at the organ, just fascinated by the sound, and I was just playing the sound, and my parents really just took that, like, oh wow, he wants to learn how to play organ, you know, he wants lessons, you know, let's give him lessons. And that, I felt like, really took sort of the curiosity out of it, because it was, I'm glad I got the musical training, but in a sense, it seems like I always kind of go back to that moment, you know.
The moment of discovery.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so when you pick up an instrument for the first time, what is that moment like? What do you explore first with an instrument?
Wow. like the guitar right now, you know, I'm just, it's just, sometimes I just have like certain ideas that I'm trying to develop, and with string instruments, it's been like with the guitar, just I've gone from like trying to take the instrument and explore sort of like composition through, you know, with improvisation, and doing more like minimalist, kind of like sound oriented, almost like anti guitar, not even sound like guitar, and it, I just kind of got really kind of bored with it, or I just felt like I'd exhausted that, and I just didn't want to just be caught and just doing that all mm-hmm. the time, and people expecting that's all I do. And I've always loved like finger picking guitar, like John Fahey's music, and growing up in the Spanish environment, Mexican environment, listening to all the great guitar, flamenco, or you know, regional music. So trying to, and it was funny because I had this conversation with a friend, and just trying to find the in between of that, yeah. Is that
the phone that's ringing over there that I'm ignoring?
Yeah, I like that sound.
I was just playing the telephone instrument there.
Oh wow!
Telephone exploration.
Yeah.
You mentioned influences. I just mentioned John Fahey and regional music. Do you feel overwhelmed by influences? I mean, it certainly would seem that here, the cross-pollination of musical styles is absolutely enormous. How do you work in the face of all of that around you? Do you just let it bounce off? Do you learn from it?
I mean the influences are more like sort of like examples of sort of like the composition or the construction of certain approaches to music, and I just like I was been interested in finger picking guitar, so I'll go out and listen to music and buy, you know, some recordings and just listen to them and just kind of figure out where these certain artists or creative people have taken this idea, and then from there I just kind of like absorb it and then try to find my own way of adding my own ideas to it. So I'm not overwhelmed by it. I'm mostly inspired by it.
Mm-hmm.
You're just greatly inspired. Mm-hmm. Like, aha. And I'm like, well, you know, it'd be interesting if he would do this or she would do this, and I guess those things is like the then I take those thoughts or fragments and try to, you know, practice it on my own. So it's I just am really inspired by so many things, you know. Just keep being open.
Let's hear some more.
Okay.
Another choice.
Let's go for the solo CD. And it's just a self-titled CD. It was released, and I just went into the studio, and let's see here.
Yeah. Self-titled meaning self-titled to your name, self-titled.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that one was just sort of, I really love working in the solo context, because it feels like when I work with collaborations that, you know, it's, I meet so many different musicians mm-hmm. and improvisers, and I learn so many ideas from them, and going back and forth, and it's sometimes it's nice just to go into the studio and just kind of a journal-like, just kind of like, you know, work through those ideas.
And in this case, it's one of those that you read the back, and it says, Ernesto Diaz Infante, : accordion, acoustic guitar, Chinese hand exercise bells, didgeridoo, drums, electric bass guitar, field recordings, goat nails, mbira, piano, radio, singing bowls, turntable, violin, vocals, and zither rod.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll fall for all of those, but tell me about the field recordings and the goat nails before we play this.
Okay. In that recording, I was just really, like, the piano, I was just, like, just working with one timbre, just one palette, just one color. And with this solo recording, I just wanted to just incorporate just a large palette of colors and sounds. And and just explore these instruments. And field recordings, I've always been fascinated by it, and just the sounds from the environment, street noise or conversations. So it's something that I've been incorporating more into my music. You know, it's just capturing sort of a snapshot of those sounds. And then the goat nails, just had them around the house, and I just thought, oh, wow, you know, I just like the sound of them. I was just, you know, kind of tinkering with them, trying to fit it. And there's one piece in there where I have this field recording going on. It was kind of, the field recording kind of was sort of like I was recording this studio at Scott Looney's place in Oakland, just a wonderful pianist and improviser. And his studio is he gets a lot of environmental, you know, like the noise, street noise. And so we were doing some quiet recording, and we just kept on getting the street noise kind of bleeding through the recording. So I finally told Scott, let's just throw a mic out there. You know, let's hear what's going on. He's like, you want to do that? I go, yeah. So then we did some couple pieces like that, and some pieces I did, I recorded the environment first, and then just overdubbed. At one point, I overdubbed like the sound of the goat nails, you know, just kind of this random thing. And then another piece I overdubbed with like vocals and things like that. So, yeah.
From a self-titled CD on Fox Recordings, Ernesto Diaz Infante. This is various selections we'll hear from. We'll come back.
Yeah. And
So Dias Infante, your titles tend to be very short, brief, and often nondescriptive. Not this time. We have titles like From Henry, Who Just Wrote, and Cranking Up Its Pathos, and Of Acceleration and Enunciation, and followed by Harsh Criticism. just need a little marker there, or do they titles have references?
I was just having fun. Actually, those were sort of like... what I did was I was just trying to figure out coming up with titles, and it was just like, and so I just got the newspaper and just got some scotch tape and just, you know, pressed on the newspaper, and whatever words it would picked up, I just put them on a blank piece of paper and just formed a sequence of words or titles from that. So kind of random, yeah.
With the exception of the field recordings, almost the entirety of what you do here is acoustic.
Mm-hmm.
Interest in electronics? And if not, why not? Especially since you went to CalArts.
it's so funny. I studied electronics. Mm-hmm. You know, studied tape. And, you know, doing tape music, and you know, was it C or C sound or something?
Mm-hmm.
And then with, you know, Tom Urban stuff, Sound Hack, and I don't know. I mean, I think I just. What I like about instruments is sort of the tactile relationship with it. You know, I love the studio, and we're using computers that way, you know, just to construct things and get it. But in terms of music, I guess it's my just being around acoustic instruments growing up, you know, and it's just much easier for me. You know, it's just, you know, I can just sit around with a guitar, or, you know, sit around with various instruments and just play around with them. And then plus just the economics, you know, just like, you know, I know that if I got into electronics, I just would want, you know, so many things, and it's just sort of like prioritizing,
mm-hmm.
You know, because I'm really poor.
And there sure is the endless gear issue.
So it's just sort of prioritizing, like, do I need this device, or should I save that money to, like, document this, you know, this music, you know? But I think, I mean, the electronics, studying electronics, I think really does still influence my work, because I think that way still, yeah.
You mentioned saving your money up to document. Is this little recording company sort of your main loss leader, as it were?
So yeah, it's like a non-profit. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just a form of way of just having just a kind of a uniform. A place where I can just release and people can find my work there, and I've been lately I've been really opening up the label for other friends who are having the same situation, that they'll make a recording and they can't find a place to release it. And what I usually do is say, well, just, you know, release it under Posh, you know, and they self-produce and, you know, give them the, you know, barcode and the whole presentation, you know, under the umbrella of the label.
Mm-hmm.
And I've experimented with that, and it's really, really been really, I've been really happy because it feels like it's sort of a collective and a community of musicians.
You've been saying Pax like the Latin, and you pronounce it
Posh.
Posh. As it's a Spanish kind of a sound.
It's also a Mayan word for the power of music.
A Mayan word.
Yeah.
Ah, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Learned something every day on Calvos and Damon. Wow. But we're going to listen to another improvisatory piece with others. But I'm curious because there seems to have been, in recent times, a rise in respect for improvisation.
Uh-huh.
Why is that? What's happened?
I'm not sure. Yeah,
I could point to a period of music in America where improvisation was so frightening a term to use that almost anything was said in its place. You know, a structured working together or an aleatoric instruction set or almost anything was used to avoid saying the word improvisation. Maybe you're just too young.
Maybe
and
so.
And you know, so that that change had already taken place.
Right.
But there seems to be indeed a new respect for improvisation as an art form outside of its kind of ghettoization in the pop or jazz worlds.
Yeah, and you know, like I don't know. I know that there's, you know, certain folks who are biased to the whole world of improvisation, but then when you have, you know, musicians, artists like Wadada Leo Smith, who have really dedicated himself to, like, incorporating improvisation and composition, it's a hard thing because I've never really thought about it. I mean, one of the things I love about improvisation is that it has this flexibility. It has this, you know, depending with the right musicians I'm working with, it's beautiful. It's like a conversation going on, and I do love notated music because you're just like, it's all just, you know, just everything's executed, you know, on paper. But I'm just also fascinated by improvisation because lately I've been trying to like incorporate more shaping to it, like sort of like conducting, or if I hear, you know, I play with a group of musicians and if I hear like a cadence or a phrase that I like, it just kind of like shaping it, and I really find it more, I feel like it breathes more and it's more free in a sense, yeah. But I still love composed music too.
Do you run up against any limits of technique when you want to express an idea and you just bang up against your own abilities?
Yeah, that's a good question. Not really. I mean, I just work with whatever vocabulary of approaches or sounds I've developed and just, you know, draw from that. You know, constantly expanding that vocabulary. I mean, there's certain things that maybe I can't do at the time, and I'll just go home and just practice until I can get something to sound that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Time for one of these improvisations with a few folks.
Okay.
That's a good choice.
Let's see. There's a couple. I would say, wow, this is a tough decision here. The Focus Quintet is a great project with Dan DeCellis and Jeff Arnell and Chris Forsyth and Anita DeCellis, and it's an interesting project because Dan and Jeff are also composers working in improvisation, so this would be
great.
A good start.
The Focus Quintet. This is also on this is on a different label for a change.
Yeah, different label.
Wow, all right. We'll have this on the Calvus and Damon playlist. Anita DeShellis and Danny Shellis and Esther Diaz and Fonte, Chris Forsyth and Jeff Arnell. This is, well, just an excerpt. We're gonna choose one later. We'll be right back.
Now, hold on there, Buckle.
Even later, we're going to choose something. Even later than before, because we have two things to accomplish here. One of those things is the business of the day. Shall we begin with that?
I'm ready.
Hi, I'm Ernesto Diaz-Infante, and you're listening to Calvo's and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your one-stop for non-pop on the non-pop international network.
Yes. Here on WGDR Plainfield.
The show that would like you to help support us.
Help support not us.
Why
but
not us?
WGDR, your community station.
We're all us.
If you're listening online, please give us a call, as well as those folks listening locally. 802-454-7762. It looks like we're a little behind in the fundraising this year. The fundraising ends tomorrow.
And
looks like we're up to, with today, about $4,650 out of $7,000. So those of you who are Calvos and Damien fans who have not yet turned off the radio, as you usually do when we come on a Saturday afternoon, please give us a call. Make your pledge, 802-454-7762. We have prizes. We can tell you about them. If you give us a call, we'll tell you about extra earth tunes and local offerings and electronic music and mellow melodies and even the stuff that we'll provide you from the Calvos and Damien private, well-aged stash of new non-pop.
Does that include the manure?
Yes, we have manure recordings, certainly.
Manure the manure. All right,
we're waiting to hear from you. We've raised $300 during the show so far. We'd like to improve that average.
By tenfold.
By tenfold, yes, because that would actually bring us up to the budget for this year, and we'd love to have that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a spare, I don't know, $2,100 sitting around, we'll happily take it. 802-454-7762. And now back to Ernesto Diaz-Infante and his group, the Focus Quintet. And we'll listen to the last cut, Index.
Thank you.
Our guest is Ernesto Diaz Infante. Do you teach?
No.
Do you have any desire to teach?
At some point. You know, I've thought about it. Right now I'm just trying to kind of develop my music and my kind of like philosophy or approach to music. And at some point I would love to teach, like, you know, like at an art school, you know, like Bennington or CalArts or Mills. But right now I just feel like I just need to build a body of work and develop my ideas and stuff. And yeah, and it's tough right now because it's financially it's tough. You know, I work part time and then I do music, composing the music and running the label. So it's just living within my means. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just like, oh my God, you know. But I feel like there's so much excess in America that people can live within their means. You just have to, like, you know, sacrifice certain, you know,
television.
You're doing day job related to music.
I work in the library. I'm a library page, and I work in a really interesting department at the San Francisco Public Library. And it's called the Redistribution Department, and it's a department where the library, all the branches purge some of their books, and we withdraw them and give them to nonprofits and stuff. Uh-huh. So it feels really like we're helping, you know, people and
groups
and stuff. Yeah,
great idea. Used to. We have a little in common because I used to work for a number of years in libraries, first as a page as well, and later as a reference librarian. And we used to redistribute by means of the famous penny book sale.
Ooh, right.
Penny a book coming in. Yeah. The big stamped withdrawn on the top of
exactly.
The binding.
Exactly. Yep. You know
what? That stamp. Yeah. So, that was going to lead to a question, which I have just forgotten. When you mentioned like to work in an art school, and that reminded me of something that at least two longtime improvisers have said. And maybe this is not what you meant, but even so, do you have a strong affinity either in doing it or working with the visual arts?
Yeah, I think I'm mostly inspired by that. I think it's an environment that I would really be inspired by, you know, just being surrounded by, you know.
You don't do it yourself.
No.
I'm just curious because we had one person whose work was very complex and improvisatory stuff, and he would spend time doing photographs in the desert.
Oh, wow.
And another who actually started as a visual artist drawing in clubs and picked up an instrument because he was so fascinated by what he saw and became one of the leading improvisers that we know, and that's Vinny Galea.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I was just curious if this was sort of a kind of a parallel thing that happened with people who are very strong improvisers. But in your case, your affinity is more one of a looker, a watcher of artistic materials.
Yeah, right? I mean, I love visual art. I mean, I go to the SF MoMA a lot and inspired by, works there and artists, you know. There's a great Philip Guston show happening in the Chagall. I've done drawings and poetry and things, but I've just really focused on music, yeah.
Where are you going from here? What's your next project?
What's my next project? Oh my God, it's an interesting point right now in my life. My girlfriend's pregnant and we're expecting a baby, and
big change
uh-huh. coming up. And it's been a interesting last couple of years. I just came out of an 11-year relationship and having to deal with that and. And right now, I feel this whole new renaissance with this new partner that I have, and she's a filmmaker, a young filmmaker, Marjorie Sturm.
Oh well, there's some visual art for you.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And it's just this great synergistic environment between us. And so right now, it's been sort of a quiet period. You know, I'm still working, still you know, getting music and writing music and playing with people. And we've actually worked on, we started collaborating, Marjorie and I, with film and music. And
that would have been my next question as soon as you mentioned that. Yeah. But you hid this from me this whole interview.
Have you started
or have you just talked about doing it?
We've worked on it. We just did an experimental porn film, kind of an erotica film, 10-minute film, and she took she used some of the solo recording and with the visuals and it's really kind of it's not like a cheesy porn. It's more like an abstract, like, you know, like a Gerhardt kind of really abstraction of erotica, and we've done that. And then for a couple months I was doing these lo-fi 4-track recordings, and just kind of doing field recordings of her playing in the apartment. You know, she plays flute. And she also writes wonderful poetry that I've been using as lyrics. So I've been doing these kind of like art songs, kind of improv vocals. So this small Belgian label called Invaded Records.
What is the name of it?
Invaded, I-M-V-A-T-E-D.
Okay.
Put out like a CDR of that material, so, and if it's right here,
life changes on the way.
Yeah,
baby, yeah. New relationship, work with film.
Yeah.
Uh huh. Scared?
No, I mean I'd probably be scared if it was like 10 years ago, but I feel like I've done quite a bit and I can, you know, just take it easy. I feel like I'm blessed, and I've met someone who were really on the same wavelength, and the baby when it comes is sort of like that celebration of that love.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm of course there's so many like things you could be worried about, the reality of like, you know, bringing someone into the world, but
I wasn't thinking about her. I was thinking of absolute sheer terror more than anything else.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm happy. Yeah.
Great. Let's wrap with something. What do you got?
What do you mean?
Final piece to play.
Final piece to play. I'd say the new the solo CD with Marjorie. It's a really interesting project again, because in this one I actually use beats. You know,
use
beats.
Uh huh. Beats.
And basically, what I did is just sampled beats to really slow speed. So the music's really slow, and the beats are really slow. And I got this idea. There was this DJ out of Houston called DJ Screw, who would do this rap music where he would take these beats and play them really slow, you know, on the turntables, and then just rap over that and then put synthesizer. And I said, wow, that's the beats just sound like really just, you know, it's just really slow, and it just, you know, and I feel like I just needed that at the time, just like slow. And so I took that idea and incorporated it into some of the music I was doing at the time. And so there's a lot of overdubs with guitar and field recordings and vocals. So,
and the title?
That one is, let me see. It's I'm actually living next door to the Jefferson Airplane House.
Okay.
And so let me get the title right, because I'm just kind of blanking out. It's called Next Door to the Jefferson Airplane, 341 Willard North.
Fantastic. You're going to look back on your document to this time, and I'll let you see a turning point.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like it.
Yeah.
Ernesto Diaz Infante, thanks so much for joining us on Calvis and Damien.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is wonderful.
From the extended CD next door to the Jefferson Airplane, Ernesto Diaz-Infante and Marjorie Sturm.
Now, you have to admit, you won't hear that music anywhere else.
Nowhere but here on Calvos and Damien.
You probably won't hear it here again.
Maybe not, but either, well. There's more. It's not just that. Oh, there's lots more from that. Shall we just,
It's doing something else.
Yes. Different cut.
Mm-hmm. Imagine that.
So we'll just sort of turn it down in the background. You know, we did have another caller and another pledge, 802-454-7762. We're very happy that people are calling on a Saturday afternoon.
Even if they're taking pity on us.
That's right. She said we were, She said we were whimpering? Pitiful. They were pitiful. We were pitiful. 802-454-7762. We are not that pitiful, but we'll take your money anyway. We know you're all home. Mm. You're all suicidal after the election. And you really have to do something. And what most people, I understand, what they do is either, you know, they drink or they shop.
Yeah. You can shop here.
And you exactly right. So if you pledge, we are still about $2,300 short of our goal for the 7 days that we fundraise twice a year. And that's a big gap, because that usually doesn't happen here at WGDR, and we think it's just because everyone is deciding whether or not they're going to continue their lives. And so we're inviting you to continue your life, to open up a new chapter, to open up it in with pages of green.
Or if they're planning to just do themselves in anyway, they can give in perpetuity.
Oh, yes, a bequest.
Exactly.
Ah, bequest to WGDR. Sounds good to me. In any case,
this is monetary, not corpse. We don't need the corpse.
Well, I don't know.
No, we could.
I have. There's one composer we never interviewed for whom corpses seem to be an interesting occupation.
Is he a necrophagist?
John Duncan, composer. He was in Amsterdam at the time. I think he's in Japan now. But no, we never did get his interview. But anyway, we'll repeat that number again: 802-454-7762. Give us a call, or just drop your payment in the mail. Drop your cash in the mail to WGDR. Post Office Box 336, Plainfield, Vermont, 05667. Do that now. Do that today. We anticipate staying on the air, I hope.
Yeah, we should mention what's coming up.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Cindy Bishop and Peter Gerard are on the docket for next week, a duet of electronics and I guess art and poetry, an unusual collection of folks.
Oh, no.
What do you mean, oh, no? What? That's not bad. That's
all right.
Good.
Of
that's
course.
That's what we like.
That's good.
Yes, and then following that, that's next week, November 13th, and then coming up on the 20th of November, we have a long-delayed interview. We were waiting for the music, and it finally arrived with Margriet Hoenderdos. That was recorded in Amsterdam early last year. And then the week afterwards, November 27th, John Van Zelm Truby Jr. Now, that waited for a while because we had some serious editing to do. It was not FCC-friendly.
Oh, well. Probably less friendly these days.
Yeah, well, who knows? Yes. Mm. Well, it's just the last few notes from this. Oh, it's gone already.
Those are the last three. Oh, wait, no.
Sorry for my chicken scratch. Oh, no.
Oh, wait. Oh, yes. Well, never mind.
Sorry for my chicken scratch?
I don't. I was...
You were improvising as well?
Yeah, I think so. Oh, please make that phone ring, 802-454-7762. Thanks to the folks who have called in, and Aggie and Elizabeth Hansen and others who have helped us raise $330 in the past 2 hours. But that is still $2,300 short of what we really need. And we have a lot of fun doing it and asking you for the money. But we're really serious because we are behind in the fundraising this year. And that is really unusual for WGDR. So please bring yourself out of that post-election suicidal bent and give us a call.
We'll even give you the Raffi CD.
Oh, yes, the Raffi. We'd be happy to give you the Raffi CD. We'll put it in a box. We'll put a bow on it, and we'll address it to you in magic marker.
Oh, yes.
Say, there's a Tom Waits CD that's still left. That's unusual.
Wait, oh, the music stopped. We need more. We need more underground.
Oh, yeah, we're going to have it in just a second.
Underlayment.
We're going to play something from Chris Brown, who is the interview we wrapped up earlier in the show today. We're going to play something from his group Fuzzy Bunny.
Ah, good. Appropriate.
We're going to play a cut from Fuzzy Bunny entitled Ant Farm.
Oh, fine. Not the underground collective from San Francisco
no,
that
no.
made
nope.
the Cadillac Ranch.
Not the Cadillac Ranch, folks, no. Just the beauty of Ant Farm. And it'll rev you up, it'll make you excited, it'll make you pick up that telephone and dial us at WGDR and pledge your most important little wallet containment items to 802-454-7762. And just to help you along with that, we'll give you a little bit more of our favorite folks who are, what are they doing?
They're chanting for,
There it is. Okay, till next week. Sidney Bishop, Peter Gerard,
and Monsieur Pomme de Terre.
802-454-7762. Here we go. See you next week.
A production of all the media.